Well, he had to. It's, okay, you want to and turn that on, please. We're ready to roll. At the end of the class, I have what to say. No, you'll see. You'll see. What's it got to do with England?
Yeah.
So everyone asks me why now,
right?
So I answer very simply: Williamsburg, London, Melbourne, Jerusalem. The trial going on now, Rabbi. Okay. I said, so people who are holding this in felt now's the time to speak out. And it's caused a tremendous atom bomb, just as you in London feel the atom bomb with the Halperin family. Why you? You know, this is, and Richard Joel, I say that Richard Joel is doing the right thing, in my opinion. I'll speak later. Okay. Anyway, today is a very frightening and fascinating Shayua. First of all, I just want to add that my educated guess was correct. I've gotten confirmation from a number of students. Joshua Rothstein, Rabbi Yehoshua, was the grandfather of Arnold Rothstein. His father was Avraham Rothstein, and if I can quote to you, Avraham Rothstein was one of the founders of the Jewish Center. He was very much involved in the fight that resulted in Mordechai Kaplan being thrown out, and Rabbi Leo Young, whose 25th Jertzeit was last week, being brought in. He was opposed to Kaplan, who, you know, became an apikoros, and Kaplan despised him in return. Evidently, in Kaplan's diary, there's references to Avraham Rothstein. According to J.J. Schacht and Gurak's book, they wrote a book on Mordechai Kaplan. The East Side and Kilat Jeshurun were for old money. The West Side was where the newly rich Lower East Side East European Jews wound up because they couldn't get into the East Side. And they founded the Jewish Center, at least partly, because they weren't accepted at KJ. Rabbi Young actually spoke at Arnold Rothstein's funeral. I remember Rabbi J.J. Schachter wrote an article about Rabbi Young and Jewish Action, where he reprinted a letter he got from another rabbi asking if it's right for a Rav to give a eulogy of low character. And evidently that question was referring to Rabbi Young's eulogy for Arnold Rothstein. I do want to add that in college, Rabbi Gil Klapperman referred to this very problem. How do you give a hesped for someone who is a gangster? And he told the story when he was a young rabbi, he had to give a hesped for a gangster who was killed in a shootout and a thief, a robber. And he got up and said that his mother just told me that whenever he came into a house where he saw Shabbos candles, he did not rob. And I want to tell you, if you're familiar with Washington to Washington, I think the greatest part I wrote in the book was about the hesped I had to give for that gangster and what came out of it. Now, I want to make one correction for Rabbi Rubin. Rabbi Rubin, you think you can get away with pontificating here? Oh boy, it's like the Rebbe, you are caught. I'm afraid Rabbi Rubin is incorrect, though. Fanny Bryce's husband, yes, not boyfriend, was Nicky Arnstein, who was a Jewish gambler, but not Arnold Rothstein. I'll give it to you later.
No,
who Nachum Lamb, Nachum Lamb. Okay. When did you send it?
3 weeks ago.
Oh, I didn't see. No. You sent it
she
to me.
She wasn't married to Rothstein.
Right.
She was married to Nicky.
Right, you're corrected. Anyway, let me begin the formal Shia. Today is December 17th, 2012, and it's a beautiful Monday morning here in Yerushalayim. Now, be it as it may, everything we said last week is correct. RJJ was a compromise candidate. Nevertheless, he was an Adam Gadol. The position he held, Magid Meshurim of Vilna, you have to understand what a prestigious, what an important position that was. The man was in the heart of the European rabbinate. Arguably, the Magid Meshurim of Vilna may be second only in importance to the chief rabbi of Kovna. Kovna still had a chief rabbi, and that, of course, at the time, Gedolei Gedolei Yisrael, later the Devar Avraham, Rav Avraham Dovber Kahana Shapiro. Vilna did not have a chief rabbi. I explained it years ago in great detail due to Machlokes during the Vilna Gaon's time, and not because of the Vilna Gaon, but because of Rav Shmuel the Avbeitin, who would succeed him. And to avoid Machloket, it's like Yerushalayim. Yerushalayim, there's no restaurant you can eat in today. There's no rabbinate. There's no hashgacha. There's nothing whatsoever. But there's so much Machlokes, there hasn't been a functioning chief rabbi for on to 20, 25 years already. It's beyond words. The same thing happened when Reb Tzvi Pesach Frank died, and we, from Jews, are masters at shooting ourselves in our feet. And Yerushalayim is an example. So in Vilna, in order to avoid the problem, they had Dayanim, they had an Avbeitin, and they had a Magid Meisharim. And as I told you, my educated guess on the Rav, that this was the position he wanted when he was getting married, a young man coming out of Berlin. It would have been unbelievable, the Rav, the Magid Meisharim, fulfilling his uncle's position, Rabbi Nachum Karakovsky. But on the other hand, as Rebbe said, had God granted me this wish, I would not be alive today. And think about that. It's the hashgacha pratit in life at times is overwhelming. Okay. Rabbi Yaakov Yosef comes to America, and I made a very important point last week, that today you can go anywhere. Anyone in this class, outreach, even if you live in Israel, and I can send you to a student of mine who'll give you a position for 5 years. You can go anywhere in the world. You don't have to worry about kashrut. Today, it's an amazing world, no matter where you are, and even with the internet, you can order glatt kosher meat over the internet. They ship it anywhere. It's beyond words what the world is like today as far as observing kashrut. But Rabbi Yaakov Yosef comes to America, and unfortunately, that's what he got involved with immediately. And here, of course, I came to the whole question of who pays for kashrut. Those of you who've read the weekend Makari Shon should understand very well what I'm saying. This is the same problem in Jerusalem. The minute you have a butcher shop, or you have a coffee shop, or a restaurant, pay the mashgiach. The mashgiach becomes subservient to the owner, and you can be the firmest person in the world. When it comes to throwing out 100 the kilo of meat that came through from a bad source, forget about kashrut, even if hygienically the meat was not frozen the whole time, hayudavarim mi'olam, that people ein adam nidon, accept kiso kaso koso. Kiso, money, what people do for money. Shem Yerachem, all right, no one died, the meat is a little putrid, but your uncle will cook it, will overcook it, will put spices on it. You won't get sick, you will get sick, so the hospital will treat you. A person is mere hetali atzmo. Safek shebesafek, etc., etc. And the question of kashrut. The beauty of the OU system is that the mashgichim are not paid by Coca-Cola, are not paid by Nabisco, are not paid by Heinz, they are paid by the OU. And the OU has a check and balance system, and it's a great Kiddush Hashem the way they function. I happen to know a little bit from the inside, and it's one of the greatest achievements on the American scene today, on the world scene. And the Chafkei and the Okei both, to a certain degree, emulate the OU. Without going into great detail, you should know that the OK went on the map because they resented, they said the OU had no right to charge for hashgacha. That we should give hashgacha all over. It's sort of like this in England, if you know what I'm talking about. That hashgacha is given free of charge, but it's investigation. It's not exactly hashgacha like the OU does. But if they know that there's no problem with a product, they will certify it. And the OK began because Goldstein, it was a different Goldstein. Rabbi Herbert S. Goldstein was the one who founded the OU. Sunshine Crackers, I mean, the history is amazing. Sunshine Crackers, he gave over the Hechshit to the OU, and I think Sunshine Crackers was the first OU certified product. But there was a different Goldstein who was a chemist, and he objected that the OU was charging, and he founded the OK. The OK today charges like everyone else. They follow the policy of the OU, the Chavke. Those are the three big ones that they accept each other and interact with each other. And there's not much difference between them. I can tell you off the cuff that years ago everyone said, yeah, the OK is Chabad. It's true. Beryl Levy was a Chabadnik, Zecher Tzadik Levracha. He bought the OK and turned it into a major Hashgacha. His son who took it over is a Chabadnik. And most of their mashkichim, if not all, are Chabadnikim. But if you know what goes on in the other hashgachas today, anything out of the United States is basically Chabad. No one in this class is willing to live in Shanghai, willing to live in some favafuna place in China. China today has more than 50 major plans under hashgacha. So you wind up today, Thailand, how many of you are willing to go to Thailand and work there in hashgacha on the tuna boats, okay? So today, there are plenty of Chabadnikim who work for the OU and work for the Chavke, and Baruch Hashem, it provides panasa for good young Chabadnikim, and some of them are shluchim, but this enables them to be shluchim that they had added income. But poor Rabbi Yaakov Yosef goes to work and kashrut, who will pay for it? And here the Balabatim won out and made that decision, which turns out to be, in retrospect, a horrendous, terrible decision. The Balabatim made the decision that the people who buy have to pay. And what does it mean that they have to pay? That 1 cent more per chicken, which is the cost of putting the plumber on the chicken. And this was what happened. And now we pick up and the story becomes very, very sad. In Europe, the Tsarist government taxed the Jews for kosher chickens. This was one of the means of getting support out of the Jews more than any other element in the population. That tax was called the Krachba. If I'm pronouncing it right, anyone can correct me who knows Russian. It was a specific tax on kosher meat in Russia. Now, the masses are generally not the most intelligent. When you see an election campaign, whether it be in Israel or the United States, perhaps in England, Australia as well, I don't know, you recognize the fact that most people are concerned with putting bread and butter on their table. Today, all right, food is a little bit easier, so we're concerned with having a little bit of a good time in life, going to a Yankee game, going to a soccer game. Most people aren't great intellectuals. How do you get people riled up? You have a catchword. Everyone looks for a slogan. A slogan. You tell Rav Soloveitchik a slogan, so Rebbe would think about it, analyze it. He's not going to get carried away. But 98% of the population hears a slogan, Mom, Ma, where's my pa? In the White House, rah, rah, rah. Anyone recognize that? Ma, where's my car? In the White House, rah, rah, rah. Josh, you don't have a degree in American history? That was Grover Cleveland Alexander. In his second campaign, he had fathered a child out of wedlock. And at those today, you'd be a hero. A guy fathers a child out of wedlock. Big deal, but we're talking 120, 130 years ago. It was a disgrace. So he was defeated in his second. He was president, defeated, president again. And his opponent went against him. I think it was Chester Arthur, but you can check me out. I don't recall. It went again. Ma, where's my pa? In the White House. Ra, ra, ra. Ah, the people catch on. You now have a slogan from the party that shouldn't be running. They should be part of Maftali, Chudlumi, but it's the more right-wing party, so-called, which is just going to waste votes. It breaks my heart because I'm with them in spirit 100%. But we have to be practical. So they came up with a fabulous slogan in Beli Chavot Ein Skuyot. This says it all. This is, without obligations, we have no privileges. This is fabulous. This is mamish musa. This is Torah. This is insight. This is vision. It's a beautiful slogan. You get a slogan, people march. People love it. Kadima, Atid, Yesh Atid. Whoa, what a party. No one thinks beyond it. Who the heck are these people? Morons. What do they know? Illiterates. What's the last time they were Messiah and Masechet? What's the... We're trying to show them. But people love it. Krachba became the cry. The leftist press, the socialists, the anarchists, the haters of religion at that time. I spoke yesterday about contemporary haters, but at that time, they went crazy. Rabbi Jacob Joseph has reinstituted the Krachba. That's all the people had to hear. They were furious. Wow, they're slaying us. They're taxing us. They're killing us. In the leftist press, in Yiddish, a poem appeared. I'm reading it in English translation. It's the saddest poem you'll ever hear. Dance, Orthodox chickens. Make merry. Have no fear. By the way, I'm quoting page 164 of Avraham Karp's article. Dance, Orthodox chickens. Make merry. Have no fear. For the rabbi, an order has issued. Shiny lead medals you'll wear. What does that refer to? The plumber. Again, you had to see an old-fashioned plumber. I wish I could show you one. I don't see them today. I just don't see them. Today, they make a simen betoch simen with paper and plastic. They don't use a plumber. It's probably a lot cheaper. You've seen it. Okay, so you know what it is, but the youngsters here don't know. You shiny lead medals you wear them after your slaughter, that the chief rabbi may live. They flay the skin off the worker, a fat salary, the great one to give. Okay, do you have a feeling what's happening here? Okay, but there's more to it. These were people who hated religion, Krachba.
What is the word Krachba?
The tax, that was the name in Russia for that tax. I don't know whether it means the specific tax, but it was a tax on meat. The Tsar's special tanks against the Jews on meat. Sam, I have one problem with you. You're going to go out of this class saying the Rebbe, wow, what he can come up with in American Torah history, but he doesn't know anything in Shas and Paiskim. Where were you yesterday? Oh man, I gave a shi yesterday that even Josh Berman will say, ah, that was insightful. Josh, Dance, Orthodox chickens. What a poem. What hatred. What enmity. But you see, here's what happens. And this is the reality. We're living it today. We're living it today. We live it. We live it. What's wrong? If you look at the websites, the questions being asked, what's wrong with Orthodox Judaism? Why do we fight so? We hate so? We're quick to invalidate. What's wrong? What's wrong? And you see, this is the nature of the person. Adam Karov Eitzel Atzmo. And I'll quote David Miller. Not the David Miller, you know, not Rav David Miller of the Kollel. There was a David Miller, a Musmach of Slabatko, who wound up in Oakland, California. He had a very successful furniture business. And he remained a frum Jew in America. And he published, do you remember the books? The Secret of the Jew, The Secret of Happiness, given away free to anyone that requested it. One was on Shabbos, beautiful volumes. One was on Tarat Mishpacha. His heart went out to perpetuate Judaism on the American scene. I have a set in my library. And when I was in the rabbinate, I used it extensively. And he writes in the beginning, he says, I thank Slabodka that I studied Musa there. It kept me pious in the United States. I want to tell you, I thank Rabbi Belkin for hiring Rav Moshe Yaakov Cohen Lesson in 1944 to be the Mashgiach of the yeshiva. If not for Rav Lesson, if not for Musa, if not for living it, I'd be like everyone else. I hope I'm a little bit different. What do I mean like everyone else? People fight over money. People are jealous. And this is what really hurt Rav Yaakov Yosef. It wasn't just the leftist press. The leftist press, the slogans, the dance orthodox chickens, he might have survived. But immediately there were other Rabbanim. Who is he? We're also Rabbanim. And then there was the factor of our, that's money, that's kavod. All right, I understand it. Some people, I'll never forget, there was a shul in Newark. Remember, I spent my formative years in the rabbinate right outside of Newark, Maplewood, New Jersey, Essex County. First Orthodox shul, suburban Essex County. Have a deep feeling for Newark. I spent 7 years of my life there before I came to Jerusalem. And there was a big shul, the Brisker shul. And they had assets. The neighborhoods changed. I don't have to tell you, Newark today is Sakhanat Nefashid with all that they've done to regentrify the city. You still take your life in your hand after dark. And they gave their assets to Alon Shvot. What Rav Aaron and Rav Amital built is beyond words. You don't know what that was like when it first began. I'm here since 69. I'm here, Mamish, at the start. So there was a big dedication when they gave their assets. And the old president, Zichrono Livracha, I remember him so well. I knew him from the Newark Orthodox community. Got up and said, he's speaking Yiddish, but I'll translate into English. We're giving all our assets to this yeshiva in Israel. All we ask in return is a little kavod, a little honor. And if you know the rabbinate, Rabbi Rebel, Mrs. Rebel told me your vote from Rabbi Rebel when he used to get a donation for the yeshiva. It was COD, covered on delivery. So you see, the rabbanim with the covered, with the money, with the income, who was, well, that, if you didn't learn Musa, if you didn't take Musa seriously, I can understand it. We're human beings. I will not judge someone else who does something that you're not so happy about because he wants to get a little money, he wants to get a little covered. All right, as long as he didn't transgress a halacha, I have to forgive him. Rakefet, I always say, anavim eretz yisbam, paraphrasing a pasuk in Nach, the meek inherit the earth. So I always say that's all they deserve. If you're meek, you wind up a little earth, be happy. But when you're a covet seeker, a money seeker, you push, you go ahead, all right. Now, that you can understand, but there's a second part that's very sad. And I'll give it to you straight. The middle Shabbos in America, I was in Fairlawn, New Jersey. New shul and converted house, very crowded. I don't know if it was crowded all the time or because I was there for Shabbos, whatever. And a guy gets up to daven, L'chin eranani, and I, oh my God. Gosh, a galitz yana, and I'm ready to platz. Here I am in the heartland of modern American orthodoxy. A YU, New Jersey is all YU, outside of Lakewood, Teaneck, Englewood, Fairlawn. It's all YU. It's not the five towns. And here, and then I listen, what about Philip? But what a voice, what beautiful. Then I find out this is a Satmar renegade who remained a Shomer Torah mitzvah. His kids have all graduated YU. Terrific baltfella. So on my talk, you know, I worked him into my talk because Friday night he got all excited. Everyone spoke. I praised him. So then I got to talk with him. I said, generally, with Satmar renegades, you throw it all away, like running away from the plague. How is it that you remained frum? Thank God you remained frum and didn't throw the baby out with the bathwater. And he said to me, Harav, you're asking a wonderful question, and I'm going to give you the real answer. My mother had 9 children. I was orphaned. She was widowed at a young age. She raised us. And she always told us, Vasit vet ois klibin in leven, whichever way you will want to go, whatever you will decide, always remember, I'm your mother and I love you. And it seems out of the 9 children, 1 or 2 went off the path, but the rest, one is a Satma, one is a Lubavitcher, one is YU, one is a Kloisenberger, everyone went his way. Without a father, with an impoverished upbringing, he has a big business, successful installation of air conditioners, etc. And I was blown away. But what does this little story tell you? Why the heck was Arnie Rothkopf offended? Why did he suddenly jump? Because little Arnie remembers when his grandfather came home from shul on Shabbos morning, or when Arnie walked home with him, and that old Kohen, Daven Fam Amid, Agalitziana, Mit Asheki, the Shani, Bemitzvah Tzavitzi, Vani. My grandfather was hysterical. Agalitziana, Veshlish Tavot, that Kenny Sugin, Ivri, can't say Ivri. My grandfather was hysterical. And yes, what can I tell you? We Jews, thank God, in Israel, in our world, in this world, in the Maftal world, Rabbi Yaakov Yosef said it so beautifully, he should only have a total refuah shlema. Rabbi Yaakov Yosef said a year or two ago, he said the only place where the Eidat HaMizrach are totally accepted is by Chabad and in the Tzioni Dati world. And he hit the nail on the head. With us, we have intestic marriages, we're becoming one people. But in the Gola, the Hasidim hated the Litvakim hated the Hasidim, the Pelish Hasidim hated the Galatianas, the Litvakim wouldn't look at the Galatianas, the Yekis hated all of them, they all hated the Yekis. What went on in the world? You have in Cleveland 2 tremendous shuls standing next to each other, which you know what I'm talking about, with tremendous upkeep. The shuls logically should have combined decades ago, and they would be a power, the power in the community. But one is a Minag Ashkenaz, and one is Epis Ungarische Svad, and God forbid that they should change the Minag Hu Zeh. So you see what happened with Rabbi Yaakov Yosef. He was a Litvak. Most of the Balabatim who were involved in bringing him to America were Litvakim. One of the real Rabbanim on the east side, Rav Siegel, the Shepsa Rav, was a Galatziana. And the Shepsa Rav, Yaakov Siegel, he already said, why should he be chief rabbi? I'm the chief rabbi. We Galatzianas know how to learn. Who are they? What do they know? I'm here longer in America. Before you know it, there was a second Beistin set up, a second chief rabbi. They already didn't charge the extra penny. They already got Sheikhdom running to be with them. If you didn't charge the extra penny, you had more housewives buying. You all understand the mentality. And here, Rabbi Yaakov Yosef, such a great individual, such a gaon, such a beautiful speaker, was soon involved in an endless problem of kashrut, a quagmire, an abyss in which he couldn't win. It was like sinking into the mud. He could not win. You follow me, Moshe? He couldn't pull out of it. All his time, he had beautiful plans. He was going to do this, he was going to do that. He was going to bring Talmidei Chacham to America, he was going to establish a yeshiva, going to have a kollel, everything. If you don't have food to eat, if you're battling, and before you know it, there's no money coming in. The whole concept of the krachba was to pay for the sheikhtim, to pay for the mashgichim, to pay for the rabbinate, to pay for the supervision. When money's not coming in, it becomes your biggest problem. You see what Rabbi Lamb said to the forwards, which is now picked up all over the world. And you saw what Rabbi Lamb said. Rabbi Lamb said that in the late 70s, we had terrible problems at the yeshiva. We were practically bankrupt. And my mind was totally involved with saving yeshiva from bankruptcy. I asked Rabbi Miller, Izzy Miller, it's David Miller's father, to look into it. And he told me there's no problem. But so, of course, the cynics right away are criticizing Rabbi Lamb. I cannot tell you how many conversations people have. Even in shul this morning, I walked in 5:20 to open. We start davening at 5:35 because of the problem with time, and I want to open a sefer, and they're already yelling at me, and this one wants this and that one, and the Israelis here, they're talking to me in English. I had to give a translation into Hebrew where everyone in the what went on. So they say Rabbi Lamb is saying that money is more important than lives. But you got to understand Rabbi Lamb. It's not fair to criticize him. What Rabbi Lamb said as president of the yeshiva at that time, when it was, you remember, they were going to foreclose on the yeshiva, that bank, I forget the name of the bank already, you tell me the name, where which used to advertise with Joe DiMaggio. Joe DiMaggio advertised for that bank. That bank had the mortgage on the yeshiva. And they were almost down the drain. Could you imagine how bad the matzav was? Rabbi Belkin suffered, his health was gone, everything fell apart in the last few years of his life. Rabbi Lamb takes over, the yeshiva is practically bankrupt. And that's the whole story where the Rav saved the yeshiva, that they got together with Ki Balabatim, and the Rav was in an adjacent room, and at the prime moment they brought the Rav in, and he pleaded with them, without the yeshiva, what future does Orthodoxy have in America? And people came up with heavy money, and this is Sheldon Sokol. If you know the history, everyone doesn't understand why Rabbi Lamb was so loyal to Sheldon Sokol. He saved the yeshiva. And I'm very loyal to him for different reasons, because there was once a scandal in the dining room in yeshiva, something went wrong with kashrut, and Sheldon Sokol said the yeshiva's dining rooms have to go under the OU, no matter what the cost is. And we're talking many dining rooms, all the way from Einstein to Stern College to Cardoza to Uptown to all the campuses. And as we're talking in the six figures, to pay for hashgacha, to send mashgichim, to get it organized. And Sheldon Sokol said, I don't care what it costs. I know this, Josh, you know, I know this from Manny Holzer. Manny Holzer was an ear witness to this. And Rabbi Holzer told me that Sheldon said, I don't care what it costs. Yeshiva's dining rooms cannot have any trace of any question whatsoever. But I understand Rabbi Lamb. Money is money. The yeshiva's going under. He asked his assistant, the vice president, Izzy Miller, Rabbi Miller, please, Izzy, you take care of this. You let me know what's happening. You investigate. And this is Rabbi Yaakov Yosef. You get so stalled over money that nothing else happens.
What now, happened to these troubles
in
the scandal? You mentioned it last night. I'm going to discuss it today.
I want to make a very important point that I hope the young rabbis will remember for the next 100 years, at least. Shmuel, you follow what I'm saying? When you're worried about money, nothing else can be accomplished, unfortunately. Unfortunately, but this is the reality. Now, he did continue preaching. He did continue going from shul to shul. He maintained his dignity. And in his sermons, he said something very fascinating. I find it very fascinating because it's exactly what the Rav Moriah Rebbe would say time and time again. And here you have it on page 168. Quoting from a drasha that Rabbi Yaakov Yosef gave, and he said, yes, I have found very pious individuals in New York City. They observe the commandments with all their heart and soul, but they are not all at all concerned about their brethren or about the future. Quote from Rebbe, when I came to Boston, I found some very pious individuals, but they were not at all concerned about their brethren or about the future. You know what this means? I can explain it very simply, because I saw it in my own youth. I understand exactly what Moriah Rebbe was saying, what Rabbi Yaakov Yosef was saying, and how they hit the nail on the head. And I'll tell it with a family anecdote. My father always told me, Zichrono Livracha, he had a very pious mother. My father's mother and father were never Mechalel Shabbos all the years they were in the United States. I think I've told you this. I write about it in Washington. My other grandparents, coming from Gedolei Yisrael in Kovner and Vilna, my grandfather, having studied in Volozhin, could quote the Maharsh by heart. As I said more than once, they went to Shul Rosh Hashanah Yom Kippur, perhaps Pesach, maybe, I don't know. You get the picture. So my grandmother, on my father's side, had three children. And already the children were not that observant. So they once asked my grandmother, how do you feel about the fact you see the kids are not observant, not Shomer Shabbos? And my grandmother answered, according to my father, the Ribbono Shel Olam takes care of every human being in the world, including the Goyim, so I'll take care of my children too. And you see, that was the attitude. They could remain frum, but they were helpless against the tide of America. We can't change anything. What'll be? They were personally frum, but there was no feeling, my children must be frum. The must didn't exist in their lexicon, in their Weltanschauung, in their outlook, in their emotion. No feeling like that. There was no feeling, I'm frum. But can we make a frum community? How can we get all the Jews together? They gave up. They just couldn't see any chance of success. And this is what happened with that generation. You look back, go back 120 years, hundreds of thousands, well-named millions of East European Jews poured in. What became of them? Where are their children? Where are their grandchildren? This is the great miracle of the Reconstruction, but the Reconstruction comes many decades later. And it probably, with all due respects to Yeshiva University and Teira Vadas and Chaim Berlin and that which we had in America, without the Holocaust, we would have never had the Reconstruction we were privileged to have. You have to give all the credit. Rabbi Aaron Cutler came to America. But Rabbi Aaron did. You're only sitting here because of Rabbi Aaron Cutler. Do you realize that, Moshe? You don't realize that. What am I saying? You are only sitting here. I am only sitting here because we're not talking. Who ever heard of a kollel? What, when kollel? Why you were going to organize a kollel? There was opposition among Gedolei Rosh Yeshiva and YU. They looked quizzically. A kollel, batlanim, vetzitzin, and learning, nothing practical when you're going out into the world. Rabbi, today, how many kollel does YU have? What's it? Am I right? Four different kollelim? Am I correct? All right, gris is tolerated. But in America, they boast about their kollelim. Give credit to Rabbi Aaron Cutler. You talk about outreach, give credit to the Lubavitcher Rebbe. Who began outreach? Who wouldn't give up on any Jewish soul? Who taught us about klipot? Who ever heard about klipot when I was growing up? Once the Lubavitcher Rebbe started to function, you started to understand, cut away the klipot. And you get to the inner neshama of a Jew, the rest is beautiful history. Beautiful history with all our problems. And I don't want to minimize the problems because, frankly, it's very shocking to me at this moment in time. So many scandals, lo aleinu, I don't want to use the word, but we're like the Catholic Church. I always laughed at the Catholic Church, and we have a living religion. Sex is not only permissible, sex within sanctity is encouraged by our religion. What it means to be a ben Torah, what it means to be a husband, a wife, the obligations, husband to wife, wife to husband, the tarat mishpacha. Wow, what we have. We're not the Catholic Church. And take a look at these scandals. But with all the difficulty that we have, Baruch Hashem, the light is infinitely greater than the darkness. And halavai, because of all these tragedies now, we will go further with, we will have the equipment, the organization, the the concepts of how to deal with it in the future. Students will have where to complain. A woman will have where to complain. A man will have where to file a complaint. People like they did in Israel, Kol HaKavod to Rav Aaron Lichtenstein, with the forum here, you have where to turn to. And I hope that that will totally minimize the problem until it becomes a mir she'ena mitzui, to use a mir she'ena nikar, to use halachic language. But this is the tragedy. Rabbi Yaakov Yosef hit the nail on the head. You can be a shomer Shabbos and a shomer Kashrut, and your wife can go to mikvah, but your neighbor, you didn't care. Your children, you may have cared, but you were helpless. You raised your hands in despair. The child will never be like me. And this was the tragedy. He sensed it, and he was absolutely correct. Now, it gets worse. Pesach approaches. I need not tell you Pesach, Hashgacha. It doesn't come cheaply. I look at the hotels, those of you that know what goes on in the United States, so many treif hotels become glatt kosher for Pesach. Do you have any idea what's involved in kashering a hotel? A goyisha hotel that's treif all year. Isura bala, not hetera bala. And yet they do it. Why do they do it? Because you can spend, you have to bring mashkichim and all yeshiva boys, chassidim. I've seen the people who work at it, and they're under supervision. You spend tens and tens of thousands of dollars to kasha. But it's worth it because ultimately millions roll in over the Pesach holidays. You reach a point where the new generation doesn't know how to kasha for Pesach. And I've seen this more than once. I know a family, she's a graduate of Central from decades ago, and after every year they went away for Pesach, and then their financial situation went in chuller a number of years ago, and suddenly she had to make her own Pesach, and she had to go to a class to refresh her memory how to get the house ready for Pesach. And I'm willing to bet that some of you don't know how to kasher a house properly for Pesach. Everyone is running away. All right, it's wonderful. You go away, everything is done for you. All right, you pay good money, but you get good results. Of course, Pesach, the matzah, watching over it, water shouldn't touch it. Then the baking, hand matzah, what goes on when you bake hand matzah? You have to have mashkichim at every point. You have no idea what goes on. Have you ever baked hand matzah? You put it into the furnace. You have to get it out with long before 18 minutes, and you can't let it. You have to get it prepared for the furnace long within 18 minutes. I want to correct myself, and you have to rush, and you have to be sure. Then you have to put it in, and you have to take it out, and you have to see that it's baked evenly. It shouldn't swell up. It shouldn't have chametz. It shouldn't have an area of the matzah where it's not baked, where it's still chametz thick. All right, you talk about machine matzahs, which come later. You know what the investment is? A machine matzah in the equipment, what Manischewitz has built. It's a multi-$100 million plant, I would imagine. I've seen in Israel what they invest in the machines. All right, today you export all over the world. It's a good business. Jews have to eat matzah. So once again, the chief rabbi wanted to get involved, wanted to supervise, and here they put a tax that came out 1/8 of a penny for each pound of matzah. 1/8 of a penny to pay for the supervision. Well, the outcry once again was horrendous. The radical element went crazy. Immediately, the sheps arrived in a different bathing, and somehow they were able to put out matzah cheaper. And once again, they mocked the chief rabbi, one of the wonderful Jews, who I mentioned his name, Henry Chuck, who was of German origins and lived on the Upper East Side, but came down to the Lower East Side every day to help at night, devoted all his time and a fortune of money. He invested $6,000. They should have money to buy flour, to start supervising, to start baking. And the leftist press attacked him that he's investing money to rob the Jews, to make money, to take from the poor people. It's beyond words. A man who gave his life and soul for Yiddishkeit, and he's criticized. Rabbi Yaakov Yosef went medechi El Dechi. One of the people he brought with him to the United States was a great Talmud Chacham, Rabbi Israel Kaplan. You know him as the father of Mordechai Kaplan. Rabbi Israel Kaplan was one of the Dayanim on Rabbi Yaakov Yosef's Beis Din. Worked with Rabbi Yaakov Yosef 2-3 years, saw what was going on. And with all his kavod for Rabbi Yaakov Yosef, resigned from the Beit Din, simply became a private rabbi. But everyone saw that there's no tomorrow. What's worse and unbelievable, and I quote this in Bernard Revel, the leftist element, the hatred for religion. The new immigrants that were coming to America who had been affected by the anarchists, the future communists, the Bundists, the socialists. Yes, yes, Josh.
When you refer to the leftist elements, you mean what's done within the Jewish community?
Yeah, within the Jewish community, of course. The new immigrants coming already, these were not like the immigrants of 1870 and the early 1880s. Now you had already an element of their children coming to America with enmity towards religion. It was what went on here in the 1950s. You read the memoir literature out of the 1950s, the kibbutzim, they took in kids from Yemen, cut their payas off, brought in chickens, took a hammer, killed the chicken. We don't need sheikhdom here. You understand? Tremendous. Who would ever believe that today in many of these very kibbutzim there are shuls where they have a minyan Shabbos and they have an overflow crowd on Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur? But don't talk about what's happening in the 2020s, the 2010s. Talk about what happened here in the 1950s. You know what went on the East Side, and we have accounts of this in the newspapers. On Shabbos, they would take a wagon drawn by horses, and 50 kids would be squeezed into the wagon. They would drive up to the Beit Medrash HaGadol, and when the Jews came out of Shul Shabbos morning, 50 children lit up cigarettes. Ad kedei kach was the hatred, the absolute hatred for Devar Hashem.
Baruch atah Adonai Melech Olam she'koli medvaro. What do you attribute this hatred? Where did it come from?
From Europe.
That's a geographic answer. Versus why?
Well, you know why. They attributed the Tsar and the rabbi supporting the Tsar and the rabbis making the Mishabeirach. I tell the story in Washington when I sat in Yivo and did my research on Bernard Revel, the year 1905, and I'm sitting there with the kippah on. He was arrested by the government in 1904, 1905, and I want to check that my facts are correct. A lady comes yelling at me, shouting at me, "You're wearing a kippah, you ruined the Jewish people, you made a mishaberech for the Tsar." All the evils of the world were blamed upon the rabbis. This is what gave birth to communism, to Bundism, communism, atheism. This was the rallying cry. You know, Rebbe spoke about it many times, that communism was a beautiful system. It made a lot of sense, except Why did they hate religion with such a passion? You could have had the same concept of rights of the worker, of sharing resources of the world, without the hatred of religion. But that certainly came into communism, and it came into the Jews as well. Part of it was the krachba, the tzar, the mishaberach, the fawning over the tzar, the obsequiousness, the hishtadlut. This was the total rebellion. When the rebellion came out in a positive fashion, it led to Zionism. When it came out in a negative fashion, it led to anarchism. You follow? And then they come to America, the Yom Kippur balls. Whoever heard of a Yom Kippur ball where they would hire a hall and Leil Kanidre, the young people, Yom Kippur balls arranged by the anarchist and youth organization Pioneer of Freedom, while father and mother walk solemnly to shul to recite the Kol Nidre, son and daughter marched mockingly to the dance hall to dance and feast.
So the question is, why did Marx have such a great influence? It had to be something that the rabbis were doing or the not doing in the communities. In other words, Yisrael Salanter was preaching Musa. And even Peretz, who was not reformed, he writes a story about the rabbi who goes out in the woods and cuts down wood and comes right to shore and slithers because he was helping with women.
Look, I can only answer you that when I'm in America and I hear a shul making a mishaberach and they mention Obama's name, it troubles me. Okay, so take that and translate it into the 1880s. It can certainly start you on the road to saying, these are rabbis, this is a shul, this is a prayer, this is davening, this is what I want to be part of. You can start asking 1,001 questions. But, see, the times were such that they blamed the ability of the Tsar and the kings and the feudal lords to remain in power on religion. And this, by the way, not only the Jewish religion. What about the Catholic religion? How much they suffered from the Reformation and all that happened.
Marx, his criticism of religion is absolutely correct when it comes to Christianity.
Okay.
Because how else do you explain the entire South America, which were dictators, were upheld by the church?
Okay, so take that a little further. So that woman said to me in Yivo, that you rabbis made a mishaberach for the despot, the Tsar. You follow? Quote, end quote. So you just translated into our world. But anyway, let's come back here. In 1895, Chief Rabbi Yaakov Yosef suffered a stroke. Basically, from that point on, he was bedridden. Lo aleinu, a charity case. He could no longer supervise the butchers. He had no income. He lived off charity, lived off gifts. It was extremely sad. Acharei Mot Kedoshim, he's still alive. The Jews very conveniently forgot about him. Just a handful of people continued to visit him, continued to honor him. His memory faded away. The problems of religion, socialism, anarchism continued to rattle the East Side. Olam kaminogo holeich. 1902, right at the end of July, the chief rabbi dies. And here in death, only a movie could do justice to what I'm about to say. It's beyond words. We have eyewitness accounts. Tens and tens of shuls from the East Side bid for the rabbi's body. The very shuls that ignored him. The very shuls where rabbis and balabatim castigated him, criticized him, bid for his body. Why? Very simple. You have any idea? Zichron, what's it called? Zichron Meir, I believe, the cemetery in Bnei Brak where the Chazon Ish is buried. You have any idea what graves near the Chazon Ish went for? There's a Chelkat Rabbanim in Har Menuchat. Anything within sight of Chelkat Rabbanim is worth a fortune. You want to be buried near its Tzaddik. In America, money speaks. Money is honey. Get the chief rabbi's body and you have it made. The bidding went on. One shul went up to $1,000 to the widow. But Beit Medrash HaGadol, they brought the chief rabbi. They were the most active synagogue. They gave the widow $1,500 in cash, $1,902 money, and a pension of $15 a month for life. They got the body.
This is what,
1902? 1902, yeah. They got the body. Within minutes, the Sarenson family, very wealthy Orthodox family, prominent on the east side, bought the graves next to the chief rabbi for $1,500. The shul had its money paid back within minutes. The bidding is over. The funeral begins, and I've told you about the funeral. Everyone knows the story. As they turned to go onto the Brooklyn Bridge to carry the bier, to carry the coffin to Brooklyn for the burial, there is a large factory right on the corner, R.H. Ho and Company. They make bolts, they make screws, they make printing presses, they deal with metal, they deal with iron. Most of their workers are Italian or Irish immigrants. They see the Jewish funeral, tens and tens of thousands of East Side Jews following the coffin. Everyone suddenly remembers Rabbi Yaakov Yosef Acharei Mot Kedoshim. Suddenly they forget the way they treated him b'chayav, and everyone is out there. And it only takes one or two anti-Semites. You see what Hitler, Yimach Shmo, did to the world. Look what's going on in Hungary today. You tell me Danny Schulman is in Hungary? What's he doing in Hungary? Touring? A honeymoon? What is it? A honeymoon? When did he get married? It's within the year? Yes or no?
I think they got married 2 years ago.
So how are you allowed to cut learning to go on a honeymoon if it's within the year, Mela? But all right, I hope he's having a... No, what's going on in Hungary today? One member of the parliament wanted to draw up a list of Jews so when it comes time to kill them, they'll have the list ready like they had in Holland. In Holland, they were very organized. They explained to me in Holland, how did Hitler kill 83% of the Jews in Holland? Because they were very organized. They're Yekkers. And in City Hall, they had a list of every last person with his religion. So the Gestapo, within a minute, knew every Jew was. Now someone in the parliament just burned an Israeli flag. Am I right or wrong? This week, wow, he's there. He's seeing good sights. Wow. So one anti-Semite started yelling, "Dirty Jew," and threw a screw down at them. Within minutes, hundreds and then thousands of screw, nuts, bolts, iron pieces were flung down. They dropped the coffin. Some of the Jews ran into the building, started beating the hell out of the Irish and Italian anti-Semites. Who did the police arrest? The Jews. And it became a tremendous tragedy. The funeral was a disgrace. That's all the newspapers spoke about. But as I mentioned, as a result of what happened, the Jews were now a force. There are hundreds of thousands of Jews. America is a democracy. You all know the power that Satma has. What's going to happen now? The power is being challenged, both with the Weberman case and with the with the Mila, with the whole problem of Mitzitza Bepeh. I don't know what's going to happen. You got to give credit to any elected official who challenges Satma because they vote on Mas. A Satma Chassid has no mind. His mind is whatever the Rebbe tells him, or at least for 95% of the Satma Chassidim. It's a frightening thought for someone who believes in Torah and someone who believes in the greatest gift that God gave us is the Tzelem Elokim within us, the ability to think, the fact that we're all different, even though our commitment is the same. But this is Satma. Go back to the early 1900s. Hundreds of thousands of Jews are offended. They're yelling, they're shouting. They're now Jews who have made it in life. And you got to give credit to the integrated American Orthodox rabbis at the time. And I'll mention two names once again. Dr. De Sola Pool of the Spanish-Portuguese Synagogue and Rabbi Dr. Bernard Drachman of Zichron Ephraim. And I'll talk about Zichron, I'll talk about him in a second so you can put him into context. And they started yelling, they started shouting. And the governor had to investigate. A commission was formed. The police commissioner had to resign. Ultimately, anti-Semitism was totally uprooted from the New York Police Department. And in the last 100 years, you do not have one example that I know of organized anti-Semitism in New York's finest. Yes, there'll always be one or two anti-Semites. And even the case that happened a few weeks ago in Lubavitch, as I later found out, it was not anti-Semitism. Lubavitch called the police because this guy is stark naked, dead drunk, on the floor in this place where they put up people who have no place to sleep. So you can't exactly fault the policeman when this drunk character starts to hit him, so the police hit back. I wouldn't exactly call it anti-Semitism. And it's all a result of RJJ. A few words on Bernard Drachman. Rabbi Dr. Bernard Drachman, he wrote an unbelievable biography, autobiography, The Unfailing Light, published by Rabbinical Council of America, I believe it was 1948. You cannot get that biography for love or money. Could be on Amazon today. You can get it. If you can get it, let me know. I'd love to get a copy. I'm not willing to pay what they pay for silver, but I'm willing to get a secondhand copy for a few dollars.
You mean to tell me that they don't have it in the Hebrew College Library, or
they may have it in the library. I want my own. Say the Xerox cheap. If you buy it for $10, it's not cheap. Better waste time Xeroxing. Get a bound copy. Come on. Can't be a cheapskate when it comes to scholarship. Money gets you honey. Gentlemen, Rabbi Drachman grew up in Newark. I have a deep affinity for him. You're going to see how it ties into your world in a second. Rabbi Drachman grew up in Newark in the 1800s, and he was a very bright kid. And he came from a well-to-do German family. And he wanted to be a rabbi. He had spirituality in him. So his parents sent him to Germany to study. I think they sent him to Breslau, if I recall. A rabbinic seminary, not Orthodox, not Hildesheimer. Be a reformed rabbi. And he went sightseeing. He was a wealthy kid. He went to Poland. And in Poland, he comes into the sin. He keeps kosher. And in the inn, if I recall his autobiography, it's a normal Wednesday. And there are Polish Chassidish Yidden traveling there. And they bench, and he's overwhelmed that on a normal Wednesday, they bench with more kavana than he ever saw on a Jew benching Erev Yom Kippur. And he falls in love with Torah. And he comes back to America, an Orthodox Jew, an Orthodox rabbi. Now, he becomes the rabbi of Zichron Ephraim on the Upper East Side of New York, Do you know what shul that is today? That's Rabbi Mark Schneier's shul, the father of the rabbi of the Hamptons, Rabbi Schneier the second, or Rabbi Schneier Jr., or excuse me, it's Rabbi Arthur Schneier's shul. Mark is the son. My Talmud Mark is studying in this kollel. You're with me, the Hamptons, Rabbi Mark. Rabbi Arthur's his father. What's the synagogue called today? Park Avenue East, I believe. Park East Synagogue. No, gentlemen, wake up. They bring in, they have a fabulous Kiddush on Shabbos, and they bring in chazanim from all over the world, and they have a standing room crowd only, and Rabbi Schneier, as you should live and be well. By the way, the Schneiers are Schneerson. That's the original name. They are not only related to the Lubavitcher Rebbe, but they are great-grandchildren of the Minchat Chinuch. Rav Babad, the Minchat Chinuch, one of the most Goyish Sfarim ever written, is a great-great-great-great-grandfather to Arthur and Mark Schneier. So you should know the Yichus we're talking about. That shul, Park East, if I have the right name for it, is originally Zichron Ephraim. It was renamed to certify or accentuate the fact that the shul is on Park Avenue. And I don't have to tell you what Park Avenue means on the Upper East Side in the lore of New York. This is King David Street. So Park Avenue East, or Park East, says more than Zichron Ephraim. But you have to give credit, Rabbi Drachman, Bernard Drachman, and Rabbi Henry Pereira Mendes came out and supported the East European Jews, Belev Uvenefesh. Pereira Mendes, Solopul is a young man yet. He's first coming up the ladder. And you have to give credit, because with their support, no politician could now turn his head. This meant it's not just the East European Jews that are basically impoverished, but it's the cultured Upper East Side crowd. The Yekkers, the Spanish Portuguese, the Upper West Side crowd. You follow me, Moshe? It puts added pressure on the politician Shmuel. They can't get away with ignoring the cry of these wonderful Jews. So that's his funeral. That's the way the chapter ends. What's very fascinating about Rabbi Karp's article, I will not call a contemporary graduate of the seminary rabbi, but the rabbis in Avram Karp's time, it was a different type of rabbi. You have to have lived the era to understand it. So I will say Rabbi Karp, Rabbi Dr. Abraham Karp. He goes, yes,
he's so much of you, he's mentioned doctor. Well, the last time we met, when we discussed, or maybe two before, you mentioned about the Malbim.
Right, did he have a doctorate at dinner?
I have a feeling, no at all, that who gave him the doctorate is like the science painter gave.
Yeah, that's what I said, the newspapers referred, because he had this broad secular education. But I checked out, I couldn't find anyone or any place, but maybe someone did, you know, basic research on the Malbim and would know more. I always heard as a kid he got a doctorate when he was in Bucharest. But that doesn't mean anything. It may simply mean that in Bucharest he broadened, that he had the knowledge as if he had a PhD from a university. I agree with you.
When the newspapers announced the coming of the idea of the chief rabbi,
so they put in the doctorate. It could be. We don't know. It's an open question. No one has been able to answer me for sure, did he or didn't he? But I said doctor because I simply was quoting a cop who was quoting the newspapers. Now, cop has a very interesting evaluation of why the RJJ venture was doomed to failure. And he says, look, it was based upon the English model, but there's one tremendous difference between England and the United States. In England, there is an established church. Am I right or wrong? What is the church called? The Anglican Church. Am I correct?
the Church of England, the Anglican Church, the Church
Episcopalian,
the Anglican Church. I was always raised the Anglican Church, Church of England. So you see, Rabbi Kopp makes the distinction that in America we were individuals. In England, there was an established church. Once there's an established church, it means the community is officially recognized. If you have a community, then you can have a chief rabbinate. But if we're only individuals, again, it's Jews. Who made him chief rabbi? Why does he know more? Why pay him such a salary? He's a Litvak. I'm a Galiciana. Once you have individuals, it's very hard to get individuals, particularly Jews, to bend their heads and acknowledge that there's a chief rabbi. I always say when I speak about in Chutz Laaretz, the greatest miracle that Israel has achieved is Tzva Haganah LiYisrael. And you know why it's such a miracle? I'll tell you one little story that says it all. My son-in-law, my eldest son-in-law, was giving my wife a lift to Tel Aviv. He was going to the Matkal, she's going to Tel Aviv. He has an army driver, an army car, picks up my wife. They're now leaving Jerusalem, and they come to the point. There's a certain point right where you leave Jerusalem where the Chayalim wait for a trampiyata, to use a modern Hebrew word, a trampiyata, a hiking point, a hitching point. I don't know how to say it in English, a trampiyata. And my son-in-law tells his driver to stop. My son-in-law gets out of the car and he announces where he's going, who can he take? And my wife is sitting in the car and she sees these young kids in uniform saluting her son-in-law. And I told her, you saw a miracle that a Jew can salute another Jew. This is a miracle. This is the greatest achievement of the state of Israel, that we have an army with a chain of command. And when you see a high-ranking officer, you have to salute him. I don't have to. I'm not in uniform. But if you're in uniform, you have to salute. Unbelievable. Think for a minute what I just said. This Jews are incapable of doing. You've been rabbis. No, Rabbi Reuben, you walked into shul. How many Jews saluted you? Charlie, you've ever been a president of a shul? A treasurer? God have mercy. You got to go to a doctor weekly to check your ulcer. It didn't, that the nice coming. Go and explain that in English. England had a community. And if the Gentiles have a community, then the Jews can have a community. He makes another point. What were you trying to do in America in 1887? You were trying to bring in a chief rabbi point blank. If you take the history of the Jews in London, the whole development of the chief rabbi was gradual. It took decades and decades and decades. It was not forced upon the Jews. London had a rabbi, Reb Hirschel. He was a brother of the Besamim Rosh. He was a big Talmud Chacham. So a number of shuls in London started to call him chief rabbi. Now, later there's Rabbi Adler, senior. There were two Rabbi Adlers. Now, more Jews started to call him chief rabbi. By the time that Rabbi Dr. Nathan Adler was in London, he was the chief rabbi. But it grew from within. It wasn't forced from without. Then there's another point that he makes, which is very accurate. It's true about English Jewry until today. The average English Jew, 85%, you'll ask them who they are, what kind of Jew, they'll say Orthodox. I demachal Shabbos. I'm not certain that outside the house they're totally makpid on kashrut. But there's a certain concept in England, and it follows through in South Africa, follows through in Australia. The shul you don't go to is Orthodox. It wasn't like America. America, already you had brought in from Europe everything we spoke about, anarchist, communist, leftist, atheist, agnostics, hatred of religion. Read the history of the period. Read Abe Kahn's memoir. You didn't have that in England. If you have a basically traditional community, they're happy to have a chief rabbi. If you have a community that's so divisive and so divided, and add to that the Galatianis and the Litvakin and the Hasidim and the Mitnagdim, how can a chief rabbi succeed? Then he makes another point. I mean, he's absolutely correct. Again, in life, it's not any one point that wins out, but they all complement and supplement each other, because life is very compound, very complex. When you're a kid in high school, you can say one answer, that's it. Go a little older, you learn there's so many different factors that influence us. It's another point. Who did you need the chief rabbi for? You needed the chief rabbi for the next generation. Isn't that why they brought him? We want our kids to remain from. We want there to be hemshechiyut, continuity. Tell me, what language does the chief rabbi speak? Yiddish. What language does he think in? Yiddish. The kids already are Americanized. It's like my great-grandson. I speak English to him, and he speaks Hebrew to me. It's inevitable. He's an Israeli. He's now, my great-grandson is the, let me just get it right, my mother, myself, my daughter, my grandson, it's the fifth generation to live in Jerusalem. All right? My mother spoke English, Yiddish, a drop of Hebrew. I'm already trilingual, but it's all with, I always say, I'm trilingual, but all with a Bronx accent. I speak Yiddish with the Bronx accent, and English, and Hebrew. My daughter only knows English because we insisted we wouldn't answer when she spoke Hebrew to us. Her grandson, my grandson already is, thank God, fluent in both languages, but his wife is much more at home in Hebrew than in English, even though her parents are American. So my great-grandson, you understand, the kid's growing up new, and this is Israel. And we struggle to retain English because it's so important for the world of computerization or the medical world. I have another grandson in medical school. He kisses my hands. Then I insisted his mother retain her English. But here you're in America. You don't want to be a greenhorn. You don't want to be embarrassed. I told you, my mother-in-law, Zichrona Tzadeket Levracha, when she went to public school 100 years ago, used the word calendar. And everyone laughed at her, calendar. She was embarrassed that she remembered it 50, 60, 70, on to 80 years later. Calendar. What's for a calendar? Public school. So the rabbi, how could he have success? Rabbi de Solopol spoke English. Rabbi Drachman spoke English. But here you have a Yiddish-speaking rabbi. And what do you want? How can he succeed? What's the chavya mina? And my dear students, it wasn't all negative. With all the heartache and all that happened and all the lack of success and the inevitable lack of success. But he was Nachshon ben Aminadav. No one but no one had come to America before with the guts and the dream and the vision, we're going to build Yiddishkeit in America. He was the first one. Once he came, he opened the doors. Rabbi Yaakov Yosef opened the doors. Rabbi Yisrael Kaplan came. There were great hopes that his son would become a great Orthodox Rav. Mordechai Kaplan went off the path. The Ribbaz came. It's our next major topic. Rabbi Yaakov David Ben Zev Lebovsky, who's here from Chicago? No, who was Chief Rabbi of Chicago? Do you know the name in Chicago? Did they ever lecture about him? Wow. There is no longer in the Hall of Fame in Chicago. The Ribbaz. Not only that, 1898. What is organized by Rabbi Drachman, Rabbi Pereira Mendes? The OU. It gave them guts. We got to do something about the future. We have to get together. We have to organize. All right, the chief rabbi experiment failed. But the OU, 1902, while Rabbi Yaakov Yosef was dying and being buried, at that very moment in time, a new organization came into the world that's going to play a great role in the future history of Torah in America, organized on the very place where he died, the Lower East Side of New York, the Agudas HaRabbanim, the Union of Orthodox Rabbis of the United States and Canada. Oh, Moshe, you haven't studied my work on Rabbi Silva? How do you breathe there? They were speeding to the airport. And the police pull over the car. There's the driver, Rabbi Silva, in the back seat. The driver says, "Officer, I'm rushing to the airport. I have to catch a plane. The chief rabbi of the United States is sitting in back." And Rabbi Silva says, "And Canada." Gudas HaRabbanim. A lot of good came out of it. So my dear students, to reiterate, it's a sad story. We're not finished with Rabbi Yaakov Yosef. I want to go back to my friend Landau, Satmar, and show you his description and some of the innovations he did, and then we'll sail into the Ribbaz. But it's a fascinating story. It's a sad story. It could be it was a knockout to begin with. He really didn't stand a chance. But it did turn the pages of American Torah history, and it's the first dirt that's been turned. Not always do you succeed, but a little bit was planted as a result. And we're sitting here today, 120 years later, talking about Rabbi Yaakov Yosef. This itself is an unbelievable achievement. And what did we speak about today? The latter part of his life in America, the kashrut, the chickens that dance, the Karachba, the Pesach episode. So sad, so sad. I mean, we pay more for matzah than bread. There are reasons why. You need so much bread. What type of supervision do you need? And if you want Pas Yisrael, so you have a worker turn on the light in the morning, a Jew go by, all right, you can, even for Pas Yisrael, it doesn't increase the cost of Heksha greatly. Maybe by a few dollars, that's all. But matzah is matzah. And his insight with the Jews, you could be pious, but no concern about Am Yisrael, children, tomorrow, echoing the Rav, the Rav echoing RJJ 100%. The funeral, the death, the bidding, the disgrace, the R.H. Ho Company, and all that happened. So sad. When you analyze it in retrospect, and I see Sam appreciated the analysis better than anyone, because you come from England, you can understand what Karp was saying. There's so many different reasons that you can't compare it to the English chief rabbinate. And the Lower East Side and America is not England, or at least not the England at that time. Who knows what will happen to England today, when once again they face this tremendous problem of the non-English native individual becoming the majority. And it's the same thing with the United States, that the Caucasian is now a minority. And At that moment in time, you cannot compare it to England. But nevertheless, do not forget, he moved the soil. He showed it was at least possible to dream. Oh, you, Agudas HaRabbanim, the Ridbaz, they may not have had shocking, outstanding success, but the soil of America is beginning to be turned. My dear students, I want to say a few words. My heart bleeds for Richard Joel. It's sad because I don't know what the facts are. I can't possibly know. I know Rabbis Finkelstein and Gordon on the 60 plus years. I left America 44 years ago. This supposedly took place late 70s, early 80s. What I think Richard Joel should do, even though legally there's probably nothing you can do at this moment in time, but you see from the forewords and the New York Times and all that's been written, and if you don't hear, you can take this, if this is all the information you need. So you see that there's a lot of anger, and I don't blame the anger. If it's true and a rabbi did this to me, I would be furious, I would be hysterical, I would be angry, I would have to hold back my hands from doing something radical. But I don't know. And what I would advise the wisdom of an ignorant person in this field is simply appoint a very good commission and let them investigate and let them set principles for the future, which Richard Joel claims they have, and they should make it clear. We now have an address. If any student has a complaint, you have an address to turn to, and chas v'chalila, we have zero tolerance, as Rabbi Blau said, for any incidents like this. Man, man, woman, woman, man, woman, woman, man, zero tolerance. God have mercy on us, but zero tolerance. But I want to comment on one thing George said. George is quoted as saying, and he may be right, I don't know, it has to be investigated. I hope he's right. Because I know Rabbi Finkelstein, as I say, over 60 years, I know his life story. And, you know, to me, he always, Rabbi Gordon too, the wonderful, good people. Rabbi Gordon built Teaneck. Stephanie Strauss is in a state of shock. That's her rabbi. She owes her life to him. My son-in-law, Steve Samuel, says it's impossible. He grew up in Teaneck, Bergenfield. He says it's impossible. It's impossible. I hope it's not true. But then again, there's very, very compelling evidence that you hear. But George said that, yes, everything is correct, but there was no sex involved. It was poor judgment. Why did I wrestle with these boys? I wanted to horse around with them, quote unquote. You'll see these words there. Horse around. In other words, what he's trying to say is, wanted to show him one of the boys. Now he's touching upon, and it was very poor judgment. You don't wrestle. There shouldn't be that type of physical contact. Chas v'chalil. And he says, I made a mistake. But there was no sex involved, quote unquote. And what he's touching upon is a very interesting problem. It's not... I'm teaching today on a postgraduate level. I've taught in a collegiate level, taught in a high school level, taught in an elementary school level. On a high school level and somewhat a collegiate level, there is a built-in quagmire in the relationship between the Talmud and Rebbe. What's the quagmire? And I lived that. I don't want to repeat certain conversations I remember from Yeshiva College. You look at the Rebbe, you know, he's a tzaddik, he's this, he's that, he's in a different generation. How can I relate to him? It's some of the problems that we spoke about with RJJ and the next generation. And we certainly felt that way. Because we were Americans and our Rebbeim were greenhorns. You know what I'm saying? It's not like today that your Rebbeim are American born and bred. So it is important for a Rebbe to show he understands this Talmud. He's not in a totally different world. And I can tell you some of the greatest moments of the Rebbe is when he threw in a little baseball. There was once a shir he's giving in YU, I think it was 77, 78, on the Haggadah, And he began with the first point was obtuse. You had to be a London to follow him properly. So he saw the audience was a very popular audience, wasn't getting it. So he says, "Don't worry, I'm only warming up now. I'm only warming up." And the audience went crazy. But he said, "You know, I'm only warming up." Everyone saw the relief pitcher coming in and throwing a few warm-up pitches. And he cannot, it's a, what's your problem?
There's a big difference. Say the wrong, trying to...
I'm not even making comparison. Chas v'chalili, you don't understand English. I'm saying that what George is referring to, horsing around, I know what he's trying to say.
Now
I want to come, that's why I'm quoting the Rav, I want to show you how I horsed around. And you can learn from this and take it further. I want to tell you, you grow up in Lachsichais baseball. How can you get to baseball? The Red Sox, the Yankees, baseball players, who, what, when, where, money. But I always retained an interest in baseball. Why? Because I can give you a long list of students who are tzaddikim today because the Rebbe knew baseball. Do you understand what I'm saying? They saw it the minute you talk a little baseball. I give you a long list of my own Talmidim who until today I know that our relationship was cemented, was complemented, was supplemented, not just by throwing knowledge at them, not just by attempting to inspire them, but by showing that you live in the same world. I overcame the challenges, and you can strive to do so. This is what Torah is all about. And if you talk about horsing around, to me, the horsing around is, in England, it wouldn't be baseball, whatever the sport is. Here it's soccer. The Rav Lau once enticed, enthralled an audience. I couldn't get over it because I am a fan of Rav Lau, Rav Yisrael Meir Lau Shlita. When he speaks, he knows how to speak. He knows the audience. I hear him on the Israeli radio years ago. He says, "Ma, you're going to tell me about soccer?" And he starts giving the starting lineup in the 1960s of the leading soccer teams in England. Am I right or wrong? Tottenham, these are the soccer teams. I still remember. He gives the lineup. He knows the players. I often say, Avot, there was the famous story with Lon Schwartz. When this kid comes from an interview, and Benji Tabor, Rabbi Tabor is giving an interview, and he says to Rabbi Lichtenstein, "This kid knows baseball." So he says to Rabbi, "Ask him a shayla in baseball." And Rabbi asks him, "Who were the five future All of Fame American leaguers that Carl Hubble struck out in the All-Star game in 1934? And the kid was amazed that Rav Aaron knew. So I told this kid afterwards, Rav Aaron doesn't only know that. He's the last person alive who will give you the starting lineup of the Chicago Cubs in the 1945 World Series. The last time the Cubs won the World Series. That's horsing around. Not like Yitzchak referred to, chas v'chalila, physical contact. Now with that being said, I now want to tell you, I appreciate all the more what happened to me in Chicago. And here, if you all gather around, if you recall, I came to class and I showed you this article someone sent me on baseballs being collected by a machanech in Chicago, signed by whom the machanech considers Gedolei Yisrael. So here I am in Chicago, minding my business. A student, the first Vishnitsa I know, Ira Vishnitsa, who I never met before, but he was my student, we corresponded over the years, a wonderful individual, Yeshiva College graduate, took off a day from work to take yours truly and my wife around, and we had gone to, my wife is an artist, she'll only travel, I have to make a deal with her, I'm going to speak here, I'm going to speak there, but we're going to go to, one day we went to the Chicago Art Museum, world famous, and then with Ira we went to the Museum of Contemporary Art, which I highly recommend to you. I couldn't get over it on a very high level, and no pornography. Generally, contemporary art, you see schmutz, dirt, garbage, color kavod to the Chicago Museum of Contemporary Art. It was fascinating. Now we're coming back. Sunset is early. So I say to Ira, we got to catch Mincha Maariv. And I particularly have to catch. I'm still saying Kaddish. It's my mother's first Yud site this Wednesday, Be'ezrat Hashem. So he says, you know, we're coming into Skokie. We're going to go to Ira Crown. We'll ask them where there's a minion nearby. We come into Ida Crown, the assistant dean, a fellow named Dan Harris, Kamotse Shalom Rav. The Rebbe never got such... I walk in, we're waiting for you, we're looking for you. And here's the assistant dean giving me a baseball, and here is yours truly signing the baseball, and here is the baseball. And oh, what's missing from the baseball is on the other side, I signed it in Hebrew, Aaron Rakefet. On the English side, I signed it Aaron Rakefet. And my quote, I put a quote on it because I saw Rabbi Lichtenstein put a quote, a Yankee in Jerusalem. If you will hear my talk at YU a week and a half ago, or 2 weeks ago, or a week ago, whatever, for Rabbi Cutler, you'll see how I used this baseball as the horsing around to carry me into Reb Aaron Cutler. I used what Reb Aaron Cutler would have written on his baseball. The audience was mystified. I had them, wow, they were listening to every syllable. Here are all the baseballs together, and I can make out Rakefet, Reb Aaron Lichtenstein. This is a Feinstein, I don't know who that is. This is Rav Gedalia Schwartz, the Av Beit Din. This is Zvi Schachter here. Now, when a kid walks into that office and he sees all these baseballs, you see, you don't have to horse around. The horse is dancing right in front of you. That is chinuch. The other pictures I'll just show you if you're interested. You should get a feel what you can do in life. This is with Russians. This is a private home by invitation only. You're looking at very wealthy individuals outside of the Rebbe and his wife. What am I doing there? These are kids who came to Chicago, 1,500 Russian families, the 1990s. These kids grew up. Some of them are multimillionaires today. 40 to 50% are wearing kippot, chazru b'tshuva. The Federation is opening a division to help the Russians become totally part of the Jewish community. And they're putting together a fund that any kid from Russian origins can go to day school and his tuition will be paid. You understand what they're doing? So this was to kick it off. The Federation arranged for me to speak to them. It was a beautiful night.
That may have been one of the most important things you've done.
Believe me, if you ask me what I did in America, that is number one. You're absolutely right. This is Saturday night in Skokie when I'm about to give the talk that's on the website. Also, a lot of Russians are in the audience about the Mossad in Russia, what we were able to accomplish there with Jitz Rubin's help. And look who has come to hear the talk and is greeting me. Who is that? Reb Moshe Soloveitchik, the eldest son of Reb Aaron. Standing in the middle is my Talmud, Lieutenant Colonel Rabbi Mark Wiener. And this is a beautiful Aron Kodesh that they got from a shul that comes in after many mergers. It comes into that shul in Skokie. So anyway, Halacha L'maisa, I've shared my views with you. To all the people that have asked me what's my opinion, I have no opinion. I'm shocked like everyone else. I'm shaking. I hope it's not true. I hope I can say when I saw Shoeless Joe Jackson, I was a little kid, 1919, and I yelled, "Joe, say it ain't so." I hope I can yell at George and at Macy, "My dear friends, say it ain't so." Halacha L'maisa, I gave Richard Joel an idea. I'm sure others have given him the same idea. You have to do something. You can't do Shevi Al Tasa.
to you, the future Mechanchim, who are going to raise tens of thousands of dedicated Jews. Sometimes you have to horse around with a Talmud, but horse around in a wonderful context. And what I laughed at originally when I got that first email on the baseballs, I now have to tell you, Danny Harris is a genius. He has given us a way to create a horse that is kosher. Until we meet again in health and happiness, Das Vedanya.